We set out on an emergency patrol. We didn't find Doherty, but ran into two enemy two-seaters spotting for their artillery. It was a complete surprise, and we each shot down an enemy two-seater, a Rumpler and an Albatross B-2. The winter weather in 1718 was wretched. Rain, fog, and mist. Also heavy low clouds, often extending up to 14,000 feet. We never climbed through heavy, dense clouds in tight formation. The leader always gave the signal, open wide, we are going to climb. We're going to climb through. We often encountered heavy icing in the freezing clouds. So close formation in blind cloud flying timing was impractical.
Can I interrupt here for a moment, sir?
Yes.
Do you recall shooting down the planes at all? Do you recall shooting down the German aircraft?
Oh, yeah.
I wonder if you could describe that incident for us.
Well, I said it was a complete surprise. We ran into these two-seaters. We went around Hulthus Forest, flew low to pick up...
Looking for this fellow.
...for Doherty on the ground. And we thought if he was there, he'd spot the camels and he'd wave, you see. And if he could get in and fly his aircraft in alive, we decided we'd risk one more and get him out. But we didn't find him because by that time, we found out later he'd been taken away. So we came in from behind, from the German side of these two-seaters, and we caught him completely by surprise. This is unfair, I agree. Well, I know that the poor fellow that the plane, there were no tactics. We just, as soon as we spotted him, he took one and I took the other. And right behind him, slightly below, and my first burst to fire, two machine guns, bang, see, was the whole letter go, must have got the pot. Because I was aiming for him, that's the main thing. And the fellow in the rear seat had no choice. The pilot must have gone forward onto the control column because the fellow in the rear seat just catapulted out like that, and here he was in midair. So the plane was right in. But neither of them would suffer long. That was probably the only time I ever got that kind of surprise on a target.
The plane didn't explode or anything. The pilot just did the whole thing, just went straight into the ground.
Well, it when it hit, of course, the whole thing exploded. The pilot, I think, was dead before, he was unconscious anyway. The other fellow didn't have, if he had a parachute, he didn't get it open because he's too low. They were very low. They were working low, I guess, for safety, right above their own guns.
But you guys came out of nowhere.
From the
wrong side.
Well, of course, you were aiming for surprise. You go after it.
Prior to that day, it also said that you and Quigley got down a plane. I assume that'd be a fighter.
Yes.
And do you recall that incident at all, sir?
Yes, I do, but that was on the morning patrol. Mm-hmm. Well, we went out to bomb a fuel depot. We were always looking for their fuel depots or something to disturb them. That was our job. And these targets were picked probably by our intelligence, and they would come down to us, and it was up to us to explore them, explore the feasibility, the possibility, and make our own arrangements. And so we'd gone out to definitely do that, and so that's why Doherty, I don't know what happened to him. I don't think he remembered either, but he lived, and he was in hospital quite a long time in Germany, and he was a prisoner of war at the end of the war. But actually, we went in and laid our bombs right on the thing, and parts of it blew up. We didn't get it all. We had to go back after a later time. But that was we undoubtedly caused great disturbances, and the whole aim is to disturb, disrupt, and destroy.
But now the fighters would come in after you? The German fighters.
They sent them up. As soon as you go over the line, they spotted them. We were well inside, about 12, 15 miles. You didn't put a fuel depot right up in the front line, you know.
No.
So we were well inside. They had ample time. And in fact, their bosses would be out watching them. They had to fight. And we had to go. So we weren't in there had to fight our way in and fight our way out. So
it would be the classic dogfight as we know it today, that planes everywhere and people squaring off. And
well, these things took place very quickly. It wasn't a long affair. It seemed long enough. There were always 2 or 3 seconds, or 4 or 5 seconds, when you knew the battle was about to open and we were sparring for a position. But it never lasted that... It couldn't last very long. It seemed long enough. But it wasn't actually very long.
So, what, 5 minutes?
Oh, heavens. Well, it might be if you're stalking something of a great distance. That would be rare, of a delay of 5 minutes. A minute is long enough. You know?
A minute.
Well, these aircraft are traveling about 140, 50 miles an hour. 125 to 140.
Now, do you recall the incidents of how you got your plane at that particular day? Was this your first, by the way?
No.
If I can ask, how many planes were you credited with?
Eventually, it was 13 destroyed and 5 out of control.
13? That's almost ace, isn't it?
Well, an ace at 5. We had to have 5. Unless it was a spectacular affair, but normally I know I had 6 when I got mine. So these are just run-of-the-mill. There was nothing spectacular about them.
I find them most fascinating, I'm sorry.
No, but you had 5 or 6 before you got another cross. And I got my left, the second temporary left turn to you up there to be amused by.
So... Temporary second lieutenant G.R. Hausen was awarded the military cross after 6 planes.
Well, I had 6, but if there had been any greatly outstanding thing, you would easily get it on the first one. But this is just the average dogfight, and you better win.
Somebody else.
So nothing unusual about it.
I want you to continue with the letter in a moment, but I thought I could ask just one thing. On a regular day, an average day, would you be up every morning? Is that morning time to fly? Or?
We flew some days 3 offensive patrols in a day.
3?
3. But then you see our patrols were not as long as they are now. Usually the maximum time over the line would not be more than 2 or 2.5 hours. And that would be the absolute maximum. Now, if you're on the dawn patrol, you might have a dawn patrol on one day,
mm-hmm.
and then an afternoon patrol and a late evening patrol. That's for one day. Now, the next day, you'd probably not get more than 2. You weren't on every day 3 patrols, you know. Your assignments were governed by your wing headquarters.
But you were up flying a lot. You weren't.
Oh, you could do up to 100 hours in a month fighting. You get rusty when you didn't keep busy.
So, if I got this correct, then, say if you had 3 patrols in a day, you would get up, very, very early.
Well, the dawn patrol, you had to be over the line at 10,000 feet at the crack of dawn. So,
grab something to eat and hop in the plane.
After about a month, I was getting fat, so I realized my trousers and buttons were getting tight, so I had to do something about it. So I immediately arranged my batman, that good batman. I would bring me in 2 raw eggs in a glass, or 3 eggs, if I like, and about 3 to 4 ounces of good brandy. And I'd whip that up into a good eggnog, and that was my breakfast. Now, is it a good breakfast? It was a marvelous breakfast. Because, you see, when you take off with a full belly, and then you go up in the air, it's a very bad thing for you. And certainly, the best thing of all was not to fly. They say now, to eat a lot of food. I always eat reasonably, very lightly, before a flight. Especially, even now today, with all the oxygen and everything else, you eat a big meal. And fly to 18 or 30,000 feet now, 33, 35,000 feet, you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing to yourself. After you're up there, well, use your own judgment how much you eat. But I'd eat lightly, even now.
So then you would get back from your patrol...
3 or 4 hours. By the time you got back again, about 3 hours.
And what, the plane would be refueled and then...
The plane would be gone over with a fine tooth for any bullet holes through it, and then if you were in any kind of battle, you didn't get a bullet hole through your plane, you were in a fight. You're bound to get some bullet holes through your plane every time, but keep them close to your wingtips. don't let them get close to you.
Okay. Then what, you would be debriefed, or...
At that time it didn't come. We wrote a patrol report.
So you would write your report. Then would you have free time? What I'm getting at, would you have free time for yourself, like for lunch, or...
Whatever your patrol, your next patrol wouldn't be the afternoon, and whatever you did in between is entirely up to you. But you, first of all, you told your flight sergeant and your fitters and your riggers and your gunner what you wanted them to do, and then as soon as you got over to the mess and you changed your clothes, you got back there and worked with them. So see that the work went forward and the way you wanted, and you need your plane again at X hours, 2:30 or whatever you were up.
To be the backup. And
yes. Now then, of course, that's in good weather. Now in yeah. good flying weather, so you might be detailed, but the weather would close in no visibility, right down zero visibility, and you wouldn't fly. And then you'd get out and run cross countries for exercise and do. Any kind of exercise, you even on a day with no possibility of riding, you could arrange to ride a horse and so on. Mm-hmm. You got extra. You needed
being in good shape. Eh?
Reason was tremendously important.
Terrific. How about that evening? Was there much mess life after flights?
Yes. It was very important that they had some mess life because. People would go to pieces, and if the weather was really bad, you never let all your squadron go, all flights, but one flight could get off to go back to St. Omer, 40, 50 miles in a flying cortina for dinner. But one flight would go, and two would remain home. You would never send all three flights out at one, allow three flights to get off at one time.
What about on the base itself? Much of a mess?
Yes, we aimed to have a good mess.
Based on the Army, I assume, is that correct? Based on the Army tradition of a mess?
Well, yes, I suppose we're more of the Army mess than anything else. The Flying Corps was really part of the Army, and many of them had been ex-Army. But it soon became particularly Flying Corps.
A
spirit of its own and a technique of its own. We had full liaison with the Army around us. The gunners and the infantry too, and the medical officers that were up in the line, and of course the forward house. There was a forward, they called it
aid station.
Yes, they had a name for it, and I'm trying to get the right name. But anyway, we were the forward fighting squadron, the farthest forward of any in our army, 70. And 65. So 65 came in on
the squadrons at the base.
At the same base. But they had their separate mess and we had ours. And then right up there, too, in Poppering, there's number 2 Canadian Advanced Medical.
Field hospital.
Advanced Field Hospital. And they had some good. They were delighted to come up to our mess because it's always lively and something to do. Their numbers are small. They're not with us,
yes.
You see. And on occasion they'd put on a Saturday night dance or something of that kind because they had nurses and very attractive nurses and they were like nightlife, and so do we like to go down there to return. So there was a fair give and exchange. Now the poor Army people didn't have anything of that kind. When they came out of the line, they got farther back than we were. But when they were in the line, they cooked in the food in their sock or whatever the way they cooked it. And so they enjoyed our mess dinners.
Because you had all that French wine and brandy around too, eh?
Well,
or was that readily available?
Oh yes,
plus your own.
Many of us was our first introduction to liquor at all. Most of us.
Most be teetotal, I guess, at that point.
Well, the youngsters at that age. It was my first introduction. I know that. And I had a small introduction in England, but a much better one in France. And in England, there was some tax on alcohol, but the troops in France in War I, whiskey was about 5 shillings a bottle. That's less than $1. And that was the best Hagen or any whiskey, and in any amount. But I found that whiskey was a bit heavy for me, and I found that good wines were, and I had an induction to good wines there, and good champagne and good brandy. There was my meat, and I could manage that. But using as much common sense as sense I had, not to overdo it. But
the point is that you wouldn't. Pilots wouldn't be getting drunk every night in the sense.
Well, some probably kept too close to the bar. Yes, some did, but
the squadron commander did take an eye.
He should do. perhaps with the squadron commander liked it himself. He had a bunch of cronies to play bridge and poker and so on. Well, we all played bridge or poker too, a little, but not much. There wasn't much time for most of us in the flights.
And bridge is the Air Force game almost, isn't it, sir?
Well, they loved it, but I played some, yes, but and some poker. But chiefly, I like to be with my crew on working on my aircraft and so on. That is my the way I like it. But we had good dinners and good brandy.
Well, I've got question 35 on now. A typical day. That's terrific. So if you could pick up where we left off there on the right here, I believe, or no, it'd be right in here concerning the weather.
We often encountered heavy icing. I gave you that, and freezing south. So close formation and blind cloud flying was impactful. I guess you're ready. On some days, we found substantial holes or open layers at about 8,000 or 9,000 feet, and invariably less cloud as we moved farther east away from the sea. All of which enabled us, after ensuring that there were no enemy aircraft waiting and hiding in the clouds, to dive through these openings and obtain a complete surprise attack on an enemy target well behind the German battle line, such as an enemy aerodrome, gun position, any archery that had been bothering us.
Archery must have bothered them. They were very accurate.
Their guns were good up to 10,000 feet, 8,000 and 10,000. Some were above 10,000.
They'd be using the box barrage or boxing.
I don't know what they used, but
they knew what they were doing.
German gunners were good, and the Austrians were better. The Austrian gunners had been trained in the Alps, and they were excellent. They brought some of them up to the Western Front in the spring of 1918, and by golly, they pushed us up to about 14,000-15,000 feet, about 10,000-12,000. We were reasonably free from archery, from enemy gunfire, around 10,000-12,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
Before, these new boys from Austria were pretty good. Ammunition or supply dump, etc. Then attack quickly and fly back just inside the lower cloud cover. Quigley was most astute in this extension of tactics. Speed and timing were the essence of surprise, and especially to avoid enemy artillery and machine gun fire at a low level with a cloud base of at an easily determined height. See, they knew the height of the clouds, and they had to do is adjust their sights accordingly. They knew the height of the clouds, and we're flying just below them. That is about our height. See, they had us cold. So we had to realize what we were doing. In a word, good leadership, fine timing, and firm determination, plus the placement. Of the primary and the primary task of the aircraft involved. For example, in a flight of 6 aircraft, 3 only would dive through the cloud opening to the attack. The remainder would continue at the upper height to provide protection from an enemy air attack. And when all aircraft were involved in a squadron formation, that one flight of 6 or 9 would dive to the attack, the remaining 2 flights would continue to provide protection at the upper level. As mentioned, our overall aim was to defend the air space above and in front of the 2nd Army Plumers. The attacks on enemy targets, aerodromes, gun positions were secondary. In early March 1918, Gray Edwards decided to transfer Quigley to command A Flight. The morale of A Flight had continued at a low level during the winter. All ranks in C Flight were stunned, and our replacement for Quigley was a new neophyte from the Amiens pool. I was instructed to command C Flight on a temporary basis.
Were you promoted then?
No, I was not promoted then. In A and B flights, and this is in the squadron, there were some pilots, several, who had spent more time in 70 squadron than I had. And some had spent too much time close to the bar, you're mentioning that. An early promotion to temporary captain for me, obviously, would not have been good for squadron morale. Best of all, our new pilot turned out well and soon proved to be invaluable. Also, Quigley was always there to be helpful when I needed him. And Seth Smith, who had been the number 3 pilot, was Quigley and myself, all during that winter, remained in sea flight and continued to be invaluable to me. Now, this went on like that during much of the winter until the early March. 17. Shocks and thunderclaps seldom come singly. Quigley had been taken a wire from us and sent to A flight. Quigley's transfer to A flight, a surprise order came from our wing headquarters, Van Lineveld. He was the commander. That number 70 squadron was to be transferred from the 2nd Army Front Plumer to the 5th Army Golf immediately. So we had to pack up and leave our mess that we'd built and everything else and go. Gray Edwards rarely flew a camel. He was our commanding officer. And then only in perfect weather, and chiefly when the whole squadron was away on an offensive patrol. He didn't want to be seen flying. He always stayed close to our aerodrome at Parkway. Our new aerodrome that we were going to was behind the 5th Army front, as we mentioned. Was to be called Merriou. It is a short distance north-northeast from Amiens. Naturally, we expected Quigley to lead the squadron, he was the senior one, on the flight to Merriou. But late the night before we were to leave, stopping, our bags were all packed, our bedrolls and so on, Quigley came and told me that Gray Edwards had decided to fly, and that he, Quigley, was to lead or accompany Gray Edwards. He and Gray Edwards would wait until the squadron had taken off and that I was to lead the squadron. Surprise number 3. No time to prepare a proper flight plan for flight leadership. We were leaving early in the morning, crack of dawn, in the vicinity of Arras. We ran into heavier weather, and we found one of our aerodromes. We didn't get to Amiens. The squadron followed me in for a landing. The weather cleared, and we took off after lunch and proceeded to Merriou. Quigley had led Gray Edwards, and we found out later, although they didn't tell us, that they had landed, having also stopped once for a weather en route at after lunch. So Quigley was the experienced one. He had landed as I did. Our location at Merriou put us directly under Colonel F.V. Hope, commanding the 22nd Wing RFC, who in turn came under General Goff of the GOC of the 5th Army. What an amazing change in style and action from Plumer and Colonel Van Lineveld. For example, Plumer, of course, and Colonel Van Lineveld were our bosses on the 2nd Army. For example, both Van Lineveld and Hope were fearless fighter pilots. Now that is good. And both often flew with or alongside their respective flights in battle. On offensive patrols, well over the enemy battle front. Not Gray Edwards, of course. But all similarity or comparison ended there between Holt and Van Lineveld. Van Lineveld was a fine-looking soldier airman. Cool, firm, well-informed, and an excellent all-round leader. Colonel Holt was often abrupt, liverish, and unduly hasty. For example, he questioned the unit of 3 in fighter tactics, whereas to our knowledge, he had never flown a camel, all of which did not make our work on the new battlefront easy. Our first job was to know the physical features of the 5th Army front on both sides of the battle area. This was extremely important, especially in the event of bad weather, to enable important tactical decisions to be made on the spot without any delay. Fortunately, we had fairly good broken weather up to about the 19th of March. That would be a total of, less than 3 weeks, about 4. Quigley led our squadron patrols, and we soon discovered the enemy airfields such as Bertry, Rossini, Escafort, plus others on the St. Quentin-Macata route. We also found out, to our astonishment, that the enemy build-up for the coming ground offensive of the Great Battle was enormous. It included new airfields, equipment depots, vehicle parks, much of which had been covered by a crude camouflage. We had no doubt that we faced the big spring battle, and our squadron had little time to prepare for it, especially for our other ranks, fitters, riggers, and armors. They were suspended men and absolutely indefatigable. But their working tools were largely still in the lorries after the move. There had been no time to set up the proper squadron workshop and ground arrangements. For example, no blacksmith shop. These men could make any part of your engine foil themselves on an anvil, like Christopher and on the butterfly windows in Westminster Abbey and in the
Naval College.
They're all there, his work. I've examined them. I can never tell. For example, I'm digressing, but for example, in that the college,
Naval College,
Greenwich. There are three, supposed to be, well, there are three butterfly windows that I remember very well. The two of them were supposed to be perfect, and one was not to be perfect. One was imperfect. And one of the tasks was we were to decide, well, I can never, they were all perfect to me, so I didn't eeny, meeny, miny, moe. He hammered those windows out by eye on an anvil. And there were many of them in the Far East to do their brass work and all that beautiful bronze work that was done still that way by... Is it in India? And in Ron Singapore? Still there.
Never been there.
Well, anyway, that is a digression.
But these guys could bang this stuff out in an anvil. No problem.
Well, they drill the crankshaft for your engine, you see. The stationary crank, sometimes it could be shot or something, a bullet goes through, they could build it. Or they repair, take two and make it into one. Or they're astonishing what they could do. You couldn't tell them. You'd go to bed with your aircraft shot to pieces and they'd work all night to put your aircraft back in the line in the morning. Unbelievable. Their pride in keeping the aircraft in the air, their aircraft, out of this world.
Was their aircraft?
Oh, well, of course. They're no fool. But how lucky we were.
Sure.
That was morale. As mentioned, the number 7 squadron had no early warning of the coming offensive. On our arrival at Merrill, we found that all squadrons in Colonel Holt's 22nd Wing had been well briefed with detailed instructions covering their duties and actions when the German spring battle commenced. Holt had some very good points, you know. Quigley lost no time in getting down to every phase of preparation, both in the air and on the tarmac. We were new boys in a new area. The weather was generally good, as mentioned, up to 19th March. We actually had about 10 days before the balloon went up at about 4:30 a.m. in the morning of the 21st of March. On 8th March, for example, Quigley led a squadron reconnaissance flight in the morning. No contact made with enemy aircraft in the St. Quentin-Lacato area. In the afternoon, each flight proceeded separately. C Flight first dropped our bombs on a bridge south of Lacato, one of the wing headquarters selected targets. Just as we finished bombing, a flight of enemy D-5 Albatross, about 8, attacked from above. They had the height advantage, and just as they opened fire, I signaled the defensive power flick roll. They were completely surprised and confused. Their leader had continued straight on, but the next Albatross was immediately in my sights at close range. Two short bursts from both Vickers, and he went into a spin, smoking, obviously, petrol flames, and crashed into a field. Seth Smith and our new replacement pilot each shot one D-5 down out of control. We could not confirm that these last two had crashed. The remainder of enemy aircraft fled. The whole enemy flight appeared to be inexperienced pilots, possibly new replacements from the Russian or Austrian front. The Russian front, of course, had folded by that time, and the Germans were bringing back their second and third replacements, but they were not the first. They weren't the experienced first line people, the ones that came in. A flight had proceeded south to the St. Quentin area and quickly shot down an Albatross following an attack on a selected bridge. His formation had also drawn considerable machine gun fire in the vicinity of the bridge. We proceeded every day to attack the specific targets selected by wing headquarters and found that the enemy bridges over important targets such as rivers and railways were invariably well defended by machine gun fire. The piece of cake targets were the new, well camouflaged airfields. The enemy appeared to give the impression that these targets were not important. But after the 21st of March, when the main battle opened, all such targets were defended fiercely. Between the period from 8th to 19th March, Quigley had led daily offensive patrols, and our sternest air battles took place in the area of Bertry St. Quentin. On one day, the squadron shot down 7 aircraft, D-3 and D-5 Albatross. We heard rumors of the D-7 Fokker triplane, but none appeared until after the main battle commenced on 21st March. It rained heavily on the 19th March, and our early patrols were canceled, or in flying corps jargon lingo, washed out. By 10 a.m., the heavy rain clouds had lowered and visibility was reduced to almost zero. Quigley came from A flight to see me and found us cleaning and adjusting our machine guns and bomb rack equipment. He was enthusiastic about our work, but immediately instructed that not more than 2 aircraft in each flight were to be worked on at the same time. He therefore would have about 70% of all aircraft available for immediate takeoff. He then set up the same plan in A and B flight, all of which gave C flight personnel a nice razzing when we went into the mess for lunch and tea from the board, bridge, and poker addicts. I.e., why work on a rainy day? We had a good mess dinner that night. The heavy rain continued until late the afternoon of the 20th, gradually turning into a dense mist and very cold fog, which dashed the hope of a costly tender going into Amiens for a show. It was a dull evening, and many went to bed early, only to be awakened very early next morning by the crash of a tremendous bombardment, much heavier than the October guns at Tysondale. The fog lifted slightly about midday, zero visibility all morning with no let-up in the enemy gunfire. We could barely see the tops of the tall trees along the south side of our aerodrome. It was under these trees that our squadron billets chiefly were located and hidden. Quigley tested the air first, and after about 10 minutes he landed. He decided that we should go out immediately in our separate units of 3 aircraft, get over the battlefront, bomb and machine gun any available moving enemy targets, and of course protect each other from enemy air attacks. Also to return as necessary to rearm our guns and bombs, and if necessary refuel. Above all, to fight in our unit of 3. I had led my unit slightly northeast from Merrieux so as to approach the battle line in between Arras and Cambrai. We were astonished to see the roadway leading west-southwest from Arras literally blocked with civil traffic. Going west with all this heavy traffic of all descriptions, including many horse-drawn farm vehicles. Many of the natives must have been packed ready to leave. The cloud base had lifted slightly when we reached the battle line and found that it had moved westward an astonishing distance in a very short time. Also that there were an amazing number of enemy aircraft darting in and out of the low clouds. The former camouflaged new aerodromes were a hive of activity. In addition to the D-5 and the D-3 Albatross, we found the older false fighter in considerable quantity. Obviously, again, the new arrivals from the old Russian front. Our low-flying tactics worked well, despite the intensive enemy ground machine gun and low-flying aircraft activity. We first unloaded our bombs on a line of fighters taking off from a new aerodrome. We had no sooner done so when a flock of Faults and D-3 Fokkers came out of the low clouds and attacked. Again, they had advantage of height, and again, the power flick roll was immediately employed. A bit dangerous at about 1,000 feet altitude. We dropped our bombs a little higher at that time. But we had unloaded our bombs. We didn't do a flick roll with our bombs on board. Too heavy. The machine would be heavy load. The leading Faults had continued straight on in his dive. He came right into my gun sights as my aircraft finished the roll. One long burst from both guns, and the false dived steeply at great speed into the ground and exploded. Both of my pilots shot down a false fighter. The remaining enemy aircraft climbed into the clouds. We again machine gunned the enemy fighters on the ground and then climbed quickly into the clouds. Cloud base at just over 1,000 feet. We found plenty of company, including our pilots and the enemy. It was necessary to take great care not to shoot at our own aircraft, to see whether it was the Black Cross or our flying car circle, Roundel. The aircraft silhouette coming out of the clouds always helped in the early identification. We joked that we could smell the camel's castor oil. Then back to Mario to reload our ammunition, bombs, and refuel as necessary. Three sorties were made that afternoon by each unit of three aircraft. Quickly allocated the general area to be covered by each unit. On that day, our squadron had shot down and destroyed 11 enemy aircraft, all fighters, and had dropped 129 bombs on bridges and other selected targets. Also, many thousand rounds of ammunition had been fired at enemy troops from a very low altitude. Practically, all of our aircraft had many bullet holes in them, chiefly from enemy ground fire. The enemy bridges were well defended by machine guns and sharpshooters. For the next few days, the weather was much better, with greatly improved visibility. The enemy advance on the ground continued to be remarkable. Our battle tasks of bombing enemy bridges and ground staffing concentrations of enemy troops also continued, but with this exception. The selected bridges by wing headquarters became much farther behind the German battle lines. Much farther to go, we were in over enemy territory. It made our work that much more difficult. The obvious intent was to prevent the vital supplies, the intent of this order, the idea of the plan that was sound, the obvious intent was to prevent the supplies and reinforcements, which were completely vital to the enemy, reaching the enemy formal troops, forward troops, as they went forward. So if we could blow the bridges and the key bridges and block their supplies, they couldn't...
They couldn't continue on.
No. So they were defending them with everything they had. As mentioned, our aircraft were forced to fly very low and were being riddled with bullets, and our casualties continued to mount, especially in the bridge attacks. Without the mutual protection of the unit of three aircraft plan, all such bridge bombing would have been useless. The defending enemy troops were well dug in and sandbagged. It was imperative to silence their attack before we could drop our bombs. When our bombs were being dropped, otherwise the aircraft, while aiming the bomb, became a sitting duck. We had to use our sights. And there's no use in just throwing our bombs away. It got fought all the way there, and you wanted to lay your eggs properly. But you were a sitting duck during that time. You're taking no evasive action whatsoever. You couldn't. Unless you had some protection, which was taken away from us by Holbrook at about that time. Our ground crews were working round the clock, 24 hours a day, to keep our aircraft serviceable and to check all new aircraft arriving from the supply and maintenance depot. They'd come up with a new aircraft. You'd think it had 1,000 things wrong with it. Well, they've been sitting there unused for some time, and they couldn't have skilled people back there and skilled people forward. That kind of power didn't exist at that time. So we had your new aircraft was new, but it's like a new pair of shoes. You had to put the laces in and get the squeak out of them. Also, they were the first to help a wounded pilot to get out of his aircraft, our ground crew. At least those who were able to fly back to our aerodrome. The rapid advance of the enemy forced Colonel Holt and 22nd Wing Headquarters to move westward very early in the battle, move their headquarters. And then our squadron had to move again and again. The squadrons all had to move ahead of the advance. So your household was in a lorry, and you never knew where it was going to be and whether it would be there. When you got back, you frequently had to, well, use your own brains and be very careful in looking after your own crew. I said the rapid advance of the enemy forced Colonel Holt and his 22nd headquarters to move westward very early in the battle. Up to 24th March, we had heard little from wing headquarters, and Quigley had done an excellent job in organizing and arranging our flying operations. His early battle experience at Passchendaele was invaluable to all of us and paid great dividends now in the March retreat. On the evening of the 24th March, wing instructions were received directing that our aircraft were to fly in pairs or teams of two. Bombing of selected targets had the highest priority. All risks were to be accepted, and these risks became very high indeed, in that the bridge targets became deeper and deeper into enemy territory. I'm repeating myself, but of course, and you had to run that, and they knew our general routes on the way in. They put more and more defensive artillery, guns and machine guns, and they were good up to, the guns were good up to 6,000 feet. They had that kind of ammunition in for that purpose. So
I'm just about out of tape, sir, so maybe we should take a pause there. If you could make a notation.
All right.
Where you? You're here, I believe, sir. If you can make a notation on your thing, and we'll pick up in a moment.
Yes.